Well, we've got several Senate seats being called, and here's how the Senate race is shaping up. We've got Democrats there at 41 seats. Republicans are at 40. There's only 35 seats up for grabs. The Democrats started at 36, and the Republicans started at 29, so they've actually taken more in these early hours of voting. Let's take a closer look now at the Georgia Senate race. That's really getting tight. Raphael Warnock, the incumbent there, against Herschel Walker. 66% of the votes counted, and it's looking neck and neck. Remember, they have to, one of those candidates have to pass 50% to prevent a runoff in December there. So we might not get any results from there for quite a while. Now, some very early results are coming from another key battleground state. That's of Pennsylvania. Only 38% of votes counted, but we are seeing John Fetterman for the Democrats pulling slightly ahead of Mehmet Oz, but only 38% of the votes counted. So that's far too early to call there. Let's go to Texas, the governor race there in Texas. Beto O'Rourke, he's trying to unseat Greg Abbott, the Republican, anti-abortion, anti-gun control governor there, anti-immigration governor. He's pulling ahead with 53.69%. But again, early days there, only 53% of the vote counted. Too early to call. Well, let's take a look at the races in the House of Representatives. There we've got 435 seats up for grabs. Now, this is the lower chamber of Congress. This is the legislative body. And this is where the Republicans are predicted to pull ahead and take control from the Democrats, who had a very slim lead before. The magic number there to reach is 218. There we've got Republicans sitting on 86, Democrats on 47. Not indicative at all of what's going to happen there later in the night. Let's go to Alan Fisher, because he's keeping much more across the House races than I am able to hear. And I'm sure you've got some updates for us there, Alan.
Some really interesting results coming out. You remember at the start of the evening, we said there were a number of seats you need to keep an eye on. If the Democrats lose them, then there's every possibility that this red wave, the Republican red wave, is going to materialise. Well, some bad news for the Republicans. Jennifer Wexler in Loudoun County, just outside Washington, D.C., she has won her seat. Abigail Spanberger, down again in Virginia, down in Culpeper County and around that area there, she is almost certainly going to win the seat. They are not officially confirmed, but is ahead of her Republican challenger, Yesley Vega. And Maggie Hassan, who was at risk of losing her Senate seat in New Hampshire, is doing much better than anyone expected, winning places that last time round, when she ran for the Senate, she lost. So she's turned that right around. So she's doing very well. Also, here's a name that you'll know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the leaders of the so-called squad of people who are considered to be radical Democrats in the House. She is on target to win her seat in New York. That was expected. And what is interesting, too, when a lot of people are talking about how abortion played a key part in many of the votes and how they were viewing whether or not they would vote for the Democrats, in Vermont this evening, they have enshrined the right to abortion in the state's constitution. That has passed on a vote that was on the ballot in Vermont, so that will now go into the state's constitution. So a few interesting races. One other one to point out, in North Carolina, the Senate race was considered to be the open Senate seat. Richard Burr retired. He was a Republican. That was expected to be a safe Republican seat. And certainly early on, they were saying it looked as if Ted Budd, the Republican, was going to win that seat. That has now been moved into too close to call. So that suggests that the Democrats are doing much better there than expected. And overall, that will give the Democrats some hope that perhaps the polls were really wrong and they are going to do much better than expected. Now, just talking about the House race very briefly before we go, to remember, when Barack Obama was in his first term, in the midterms, he lost 63 House seats. Donald Trump lost 41. Both of them were considering quite a hammering. The polls were predicting Joe Biden might lose around 25, but he's doing better than expected, winning seats that the Republicans really needed to win to make sure that this red wave wasn't just something they talked about, but was actually a thing.
OK, Alan, thanks very much for bringing us the view there on the House of Representatives. Republicans have been dominating Florida tonight, with Ron DeSantis re-elected as governor and Marco Rubio getting another term in the Senate. They've been reacting over the past hour, and we're expecting Donald Trump to react now. He's just about to speak from Mar-a-Lago in Florida.
We have some races that are hot and heavy, and we're all watching them here. And some of you like the music so much that you'd rather hear the music, and I understand that very well. So we're doing combinations of both. I'd like to welcome the fake news media, which is back there. There's a lot of people back there. That's incredible. That's a big group. They must be expecting something big tonight. Actually, they were hoping for big losses, but that's not happening. So the numbers have been amazing so far. Now, this is just up until this point. But as of this moment on endorsements, with the nominations, we had a total of 330 endorsements on nominations. This is only on nominations. This isn't for tonight. And of the 330, we won 200. We won 324. So if you think 224, and some of those were long shots, in all fairness. They were down in fifth place. We had a lot of people in fifth place that went to first, but it was 224 out of 330, and that's a pretty good number. And then tonight, because they kept saying, well, he's good on nominations, but is he good on the general election? So as of this moment, and we have some out there, we are 80 wins and 3 losses. Is that good? Wouldn't that be funny if we were better on the general election than the nominations themselves? So that's great. Now, in North Carolina, just out, Ted Budd is now leading, doing great. He's leading 51-47. In Missouri, very good guy, Eric Schmidt, is now up 55-43, and he's against a Bush, but a different Bush. It's called an Anheuser-Busch. That's a different Bush. You tell me which is the real Bush. In Ohio, J.D. Vance is now leading, 52-47. And we had an incredible rally last night in Ohio. And you saw that in Florida, Marco Rubio, we had an unbelievable rally for Marco the night before with the heaviest rain I've ever been involved with. I was up there. It was beautiful. Everything. This is the tropics, right? Florida. It was so beautiful. It was the most beautiful night. And all of a sudden, it turned deadly dark. And it was like you had massive pails of water that just fell on top of me. We went through the worst storm, but we gutted it out. I had no teleprompters. We had 45,000 people out there. We had no teleprompter. And I said, I wonder what Biden would do right now. But we gutted it out. And it was amazing. But Marco had a fantastic evening at 58-41, that's really tremendous. That's as of this moment. Katie Britt, I want to congratulate Katie Britt. We endorse Katie, and she did fantastically. 68-30, that means she has a future, young and just a fantastic woman with a husband who's great. He's maybe the largest human being I've ever seen. He was an offensive lineman in the NFL for a long time and a great football player, actually. Played for Alabama. But, Katie, congratulations to you. And we have a lot of other good ones going out there. Herschel's leading right now. So we have a lot of big races going on right now. So enjoy that. Enjoy the food and enjoy everything. And really, in all fairness, it is a great honor to have the media with us. And we hope you enjoy yourself. And
We're going to leave ex-former President Donald Trump speaking at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Let's bring in John Hendren. He's live in Atlanta, in Georgia. I made the little gaffe there, calling him president. Of course, we're all expecting him to announce a run for the 2024 presidential election. Not done it yet. And, of course, tonight is not really about President Trump, ex-President Trump anyway. He is talking all about his successes, about the Republicans' successes. But are the Republicans doing as well as he says they are outside of Florida?
Thank you. Well, it does seem like they're not having a bad night so far. Herschel Walker was endorsed by Trump, the Republican running in this race here in Georgia. He was endorsed by Trump. He's a good friend of Trump. He invokes Trump's name often. And he's neck and neck with this sitting senator, Raphael Warnock, the Democrat, who won here in a special election just a little over a year ago in January 2021. So those Trump endorsements, you heard him bragging about them, they do seem to matter among Republican voters. He hasn't put Herschel Walker over the top yet in Georgia. That's for voters to decide. But he seems to have had a relatively good night. You heard Trump bragging that he was, in his count, 80-3. He was had 80 endorsements where they succeeded tonight and 3 where they haven't. But we'll see what happens with this big Senate election here. There are others. He did not, you'll notice, congratulate Ron DeSantis for winning the governorship of Florida. One good reason for that is that DeSantis has already not promised that he was going to serve out his entire term because he is considered a leading candidate for the presidency, for the Republican nomination for the presidency in 2024. And that would mean if Trump announces that he will run, his main rival at this point anyway would seem to be Ron DeSantis. So hard to say what will happen with that, but it's notable that Trump didn't congratulate him.
It's good news that you've got some earphones on there, John, because it's pretty noisy, isn't it? That party is determined to keep going, even though we haven't got a clear winner yet in the Senate race. Tell us a little bit about the governor's race. So we've got Stacey Abrams attempting at a rematch against Brian Kemp. Who's coming out on top there?
Yeah, Brian Kemp has really outperformed even the polls ahead of time. Stacey Abrams is actually running behind where she ran last time around. This is a rematch race. So it's not terribly surprising that this race might be close here, the Warnock-Walker race, the Abrams race. And against Brian Kemp seems to be going about as we expected. So what we're seeing in Georgia is different than what we've seen in Florida. In Florida, we've seen blowout margins larger than the polls ahead of the election. And here what we're seeing so far is about what we expected. When you look at the Herschel Walker versus Raphael Warnock race, that is neck and neck, which is what we expected. And if it were to be called at this point with over 70% of the vote counted, they'd have to do a rematch in December. Interestingly, in that race, there is an independent, a libertarian, who's getting about 2% of the vote. One would normally expect that the libertarian vote would come at the expense of the Republican. So it is possible the Republicans here are even outperforming. But so far, we're not really seeing that. In Florida, we certainly are. But it's yet to be determined here. And it could be a long night, could be another couple of weeks if there is a rematch here.
Indeed, it does. Okay, John, thanks very much for the moment for joining us there from Georgia. Let's go back now to Washington, D.C. there. Patty Culhane is hosting her panel of guests for more lively discussion. Patty.
Thanks so much, Laura. There is so much to talk to about, and it's just we're just in the middle of it. So I want to introduce my guest. Joining me now is Jennifer Victor, professor of political science at George Mason University, Ashad Hassan, a Democratic strategist, and Jocelyn Castillo, she's a Republican strategist. So we just heard the voice of Donald Trump doing what we all expected Donald Trump to do, is take pretty much credit for this election. I want to talk first about some of the Trump-backed candidates. So in a normal universe, Herschel Walker, who is a football player, who didn't live in that state necessarily, goes to Georgia, has one of the worst debates, can't really even seem to speak. Then it comes out that he's got domestic violence allegations, very credible ones. Then it comes out that he's allegedly paid for not one, but two abortions, and he might win evangelicals against Raphael Warnock, who's an actual preacher. So, Ashad, to you, what? Really, what?
I mean, this is an indication that this is, in addition to two candidates running for Senate, this is a national election. So the issues that the Democratic Party, the Republican Party are talking about are really sort of the issues that people are talking about. Generally, Americans will talk a lot, and the media in particular will talk a lot about character issues. But when it comes time to vote at the polls, Americans think about, okay, which direction do I want to take this country? And Georgia is going to be an excellent example of two very different visions for who this country is, who we are, and what it is we value and cherish. So, sure, Walker is certainly a non-traditional candidate, not by any measure a particularly strong candidate.
Non-traditional is it? Yeah, that's one word for it, yeah.
But he is running in a very Republican state. Remember, we just turned Georgia blue this last cycle. Before that, it was Republican for decades. So, sure, there's going to be plenty of Republicans who are going to vote just as they have been voting for a very long time. And that is going to have not much to do with the fact that Walker isn't particularly competent on a debate stage or that Walker has a lot of skeletons in his closet. It's going to have more to do with the anxieties that voters have and the way that Republicans have been able to capitalize on those, less about Walker.
Jocelyn, you're a Republican. Do you look at Herschel Walker and go, that's my guy?
Well, you know, I think you made a good point. Republicans have had that state in the bag. And, you know, in the last election, that was an anomaly. And so when you look at the growing population in Atlanta, that is becoming obviously more of a blue state these days, how much is the Latino vote, the independent vote, going to go for Walker, not necessarily because of the candidate themselves, but the issues that he is presenting? We talked about inflation in your last segment. I think that is front of mind for a lot of voters. We're talking about the rise in crime. I think people want to change. They're paying more, getting less. And who is the candidate at the end of the day that is going to vote for the right policies and form the coalitions in Congress to get the majorities that we need to pursue the policies that voters want to see? And I think some voters may be able to see Walker as a vehicle for that.
As a Republican, are you proud that he's your candidate?
I think I'm proud of anybody that will pursue the right policies. Obviously, you know, I think primaries have been very tough in certain Republican states. You look at Missouri, for instance, Eric Schmitz was able to pull it off. But, you know, oftentimes there is that desire to pull a little bit more to the right. And I think when you're looking at national contests and statewide contests, you do want a candidate that is able to win a statewide race. Do I wish that, you know, we were in a position where that state could be called within the first 10 minutes, obviously. But ultimately, I think that what we want is the majorities in Congress to be able to pursue the policies that we need, which is to stop spending, to stop the bleeding, and to be able to get back on a fiscal, you know, sustainability path. And I think Walker can be that candidate once he gets here, if that's that's what happens tonight.
Jennifer, what does this say to you about the future of the Republican Party?
Well, so I think what we're seeing is that for a lot of Americans, your party ID, your partisanship, is an increasingly important part of your identity. You know, 20 years ago, if you asked people to describe the most important characteristics that describe who they are, they might talk about their gender, their religion, maybe their occupation or where they're from, region or something like that. But these days, increasingly, partisanship is right up there. And because partisanship is such an important, critical part about how people see themselves, about who they identify as being on their team or in their safe space and who is dangerous to them, it makes it a lot easier to make a lot of excuses for maybe people that you wouldn't have made excuses for before, in that sense.
Is this the post-shame period of American politics? I mean,
maybe.
I mentioned earlier, covered the Bill Clinton rally, one of my first as a young Cub reporter. Yes, I'm very old. I know you're all doing the math. He was almost downed by the fact that he said he inhaled a joint or he smoked a joint, but he didn't inhale it. So how do you go from that to the tape from Donald Trump to now these candidates who are like, yes, there's credible allegations that he beat his wife and paid for abortions, and he still gets the Republican vote. So what does that say? Go ahead. You want to?
Well, I think it's down to one's own partisans to do the disciplining, right? So we have seen some people taken down for scandal over the last 10 years, but they've been taken down by their own party, not by the other party.
They were all Democrats.
Yes. So, for example, if you have Al Franken, the Democratic Party asked him or pressured him to cut it out and get out of here. Mm-hmm. You don't have that same kind of pressure on the Republican side. And that's something that many Democrats sort of talk about and fret about. But for those same Democrats, it is important that we stick to our values. And I think the Georgians get to make that decision now in Georgia, whether or not to stick to their own values, if those personal convictions are really important to them. Here's one thing I do have some hope for. As we're talking about, like, partisan ID is so important, as well as other identifications, I do still think that there is room for finding common ground and common values that we all share. And I'm not saying this because I'm being, you know, Pollyannish or super optimistic. I'm saying this because I'm actually worried about this. We do often find common ground and values, but often when divisiveness becomes a political strategy, it separates us rather than unites us.
Absolutely.
And when you have people like Ron DeSantis running policies and running stunts that are meant to be divisive, then we lose track of the fact that we do, all of us Americans, want to be in a position where we can be prosperous and provide for our families. We do all, as Americans, want to be safe in our homes and communities and schools. That is true. But then when you have people like Donald Trump running to say that some of these Americans are cheaters, some of these Americans aren't even actually Americans, and many of these Americans are secretly conspiring against you, then it erodes our ability to find common ground with each other.
Justin, let me ask you this, because it seems, you know, and I think it's important to point out that there was a Democratic move in the primaries to bolster up these Trump candidates. So there's been a lot of criticism that they said, oh, these candidates are a threat to democracy. But, for example, in the Maryland governor's race, they propped up the Republican had spent like $21,000 on ads, and the Democrats spent $1.15 million being like, he's Donald Trump's choice. He's too dangerous. And so then he gets the nomination. If this is the party of Trump, how would you ever do what Asha just said, which is figure our way back?
I mean, you're looking at Kurt Schrader in Oregon not coming back. And, you know, I think the moderates in both parties are being filtered out. And that is that's to the detriment of our institutions. And so you pointed out Democrats and the Democratic machine spending money against Republicans that actually work across the aisle. Look at Peter Meyer in Michigan. Mm-hmm. That was a member that came here to actually talk about civility, voted with Democrats a great percentage of the time, and they ousted him. They spent a great amount of money to do that. And so I think there's a bit of hypocriticism happening on both sides. And, you know, at the end of the day, the louder voices are starting to take hold. And I think that this election is going to show us just how tired voters are, I think, of both sides, frankly, when it comes to catering to the more radical, you know, smallest margins of their base. People want solutions. They want to put food on the table. They want to be safe. They want members to work together. They sent Washington with a 50-50 Senate majority last Congress, and instead, this administration and Congress pushed through with a reconciliation bill on a partisan basis to try to do away with the filibuster, to try to, increase the number of Supreme Court justices. That's not the mandate that they had.
They didn't try to increase the number of Supreme Court justices. There was talk of it, but they didn't actually do it. But I don't know if we were on a wide shot or if you could see these two faces over here. They were both. So, Asha, go ahead.
Can we not pretend that this is both sides? Because this isn't the same. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party are not mirror images of each other. Democrats not only have moderates, but we have conservatives, senators like Manchin and Sinema, who have extraordinary say within their own party and determine the direction of policy. Just as we have people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The Republican Party is far more uniform, not just in terms of how it is ideologically, but how it is demographically. Let us not underestimate the fact, let's not forget the fact that the Republican Party relies overwhelmingly on one type, one race of Americans to come out to vote. And that's when it becomes divisive like this, it rips apart the shared values, the shared fabrics. And that's when you have this kind of extremism. There will always be primaries on both sides, and I'm progressive, so I'm going to make sure that my side is represented in the Democratic Party. But I'm not calling to question the legitimacy of the election and having practically the entire, congressional delegation of my side saying, yeah, this isn't there. We don't really have a president.
Jennifer, you made a face, and I am going to get to you, but guess who's talking? Who have we all been talking about? Herschel Walker.
Oh, boy.
He's talking, and we are going to, our audience now, it's perfect, right? See for yourselves what we were talking about. Here you go. Herschel Walker speaking in Georgia.
And I want to thank you guys for coming out, and thank you guys for being here, and thank you guys for all your support. I'm not leaving. I'm up there, they call it a war room, and I said, it's a blessing. And I'm up there in this room that I've been blessed. So I'm ready, and I know you guys are ready as well. So, hey, God bless you guys. Let's just keep it going. God bless. Thank you guys so much.
That's Herschel Walker speaking there in Georgia. Let's go to the White House, our correspondent, Mike Hanna. These midterms, they really are a referendum, aren't they, Mike, on Biden, on the administration, on the past 2 years. What's America saying?
Well, every time in the midterms, yes, it is a referendum on the current administration, whether that administration likes it or not. President Biden has been attempting to steer the conversation away from that particular fact, as have his fellow Democrats. But traditionally and every midterm, yes, it is a referendum on the administration and what the administration has achieved. Now, certainly the Biden administration has had an up and down year. At the beginning of this year, President Biden's opinion ratings were exceedingly low, sinking in the face of increasing prices, increasing gas shortages, increasing prices of gas, of rentals, of accommodation, rising interest rates. And certainly at that particular stage, the Republicans were thinking they are going to take it all in these midterm elections. But then there was something of a comeback by the administration. They succeeded in passing some exceedingly significant legislation. President Biden and his advisors managed to push back the price of gas, which dropped significantly. So they did pull it back to a certain degree. But the question is whether the people of America think that, and that is what the results are going to show in the course of the evening. Individual items that are a factor in these elections, obviously, the Roe v. Wade decision by the Supreme Court did, to a certain extent, galvanize voters in many areas. There was a massive uptick in the terms of voters who were registered in the wake of that particular vote. But generally, in the end, what it is, you quite correctly say, is a referendum on the administration and the 2 years it's been in power.
Mike, thanks very much. We're going to go straight now to Vermont, where we are listening to, we can listen to, Becca Ballant. She's the representative who's been elected there in Vermont.
First time, because I refused to accept that the richest nation in the world, could not take care of working families, could not house them, could not feed them, could not give them health care. I had kids in my own classroom who I know were living in tents or in cars, whose parents were struggling with addiction. I still believe that we have to turn towards each other in our communities. That's how we're gonna find our way through, for each other and for our communities. When we started out in this race, we were down in the polls. We didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have a lot of endorsements. But we never stopped believing that if we pulled people together and ran an authentic, genuine race where people could see what I was about, that they would come to us because they wanted something different. This campaign is proof, that incredible power of connection. We are craving it. We're a nation that is fraught with loneliness and disconnection. This campaign renewed my hope in the power and the spirit that comes from truly seeing one another.
That's Becca Ballant, who's just been elected as the House representative in Vermont. That is the state, Vermont State's first woman that they are sending to Congress. She's also a member of the LGBTQ plus community. Well, many glass ceilings have been broken tonight. We've also got the Massachusetts governor race, the first elected female governor there from also the LGBTQ plus community. And that's Maura Healey. She's a Democrat. She beat Jeff Deal. He's Republican. Arkansas governor race was also the first woman to lead the state. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, you might recognize her as the former White House press secretary under Donald Trump. She beat Chris Jones very convincingly there. And Maryland will get its first black governor, Wes Moore. He's the Democrat that is the projected winner there, running against Dan Cox, the Republican. All eyes still on the key battleground state of Pennsylvania. However, Dr. Mehmet Oz, the Republican television celebrity, would be the first senator, Muslim senator, if he wins against John Fetterman. He's the Democrat, but with only just over half the votes counted, it's looking pretty close there, too close to call. That is a race that may take a number of days to get the results from. Let's take an overall look at the Senate race. This is the map of the United States. We've got Republicans being projected winners in all the red Senate races. We've got Missouri, Kansas, North and South Dakota, Florida, Arkansas, two Oklahoma Senate seats, Indiana, Kentucky, Alabama and South Carolina. Democrats are projected winners in New York, Illinois, Connecticut, Maryland and Vermont. Let's bring in Maya Berry. She's executive director of the Arab American Institute and a representative at Yalla Vote. That's a voter mobilization organization. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Now, I know you want to talk about mobilization of voting, and we will get onto it. First of all, we've got to address that we're seeing some firsts tonight, aren't we, in the ballot box?
We are. That's always exciting to see. I think when we make some groundbreaking moves, and I'm a Maryland voter, so seeing our first African-American elected to governor is certainly exciting.
What do you think of the vote overall? Do you think it's going according to how the polls suggested that it was going to?
No, I think perhaps the only place that that's what's playing out today is Florida. The rest of the country, I think most political pundits were smart enough to say this idea of a red wave is a little too early to predict. If you looked at the polling going into the election day, most of it was within the margin of error. So, frankly, at a certain point, it didn't become useful exercise to continue to look at the polling. It is close, and I don't think we're going to know the results of all of these races tonight.
How does your organization work? How do you get people to mobilize the vote? Because this has been a key issue for quite a few governors. Stacey Abrams is talking about vote suppression. She's been key at leading people who feel disenfranchised to the ballot box. How easy is it? How do you go about it?
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting question because we launched Yalla Vote back in 1998, and it was specifically a voter engagement project. And it is, as you say, just reminding people that you have to get out the vote. You have to go and make sure to properly participate in your democracy. You are voting. And at that time, and for certainly well over a decade into that, it was mostly about turning out the vote. Regrettably, as we've seen more recently, that the voter engagement efforts cannot just be about making sure you go vote. We have to deal with a lot of voter suppression issues that have been taking place. We have to deal with a lot of disinformation that's been taking place. So what used to be just turning out voters is now a lot of voter education to tell them that some of the things that are surfacing in their social media feeds, among their sort of bifurcated media outlets, are not necessarily what is factual. And we do a lot of work having to say, this is true, this is not true, please stay the course and continue to participate in the process. And to be clear, we're a nonpartisan institution, so I don't necessarily care which way a voter votes. I just want to make sure they're engaged in the process and participating.
Getting voters to the ballot box is one thing. What about the situation afterwards? We've got a record number of people who are election deniers, we call them now, on the ballot. How much of a problem is this?
Yep. That is a huge problem. I cannot understate the problem of going into a midterm election with roughly 300 people who do not believe the election of 2020 was decided accurately. So when you talk about election deniers, you're talking about people who do not acknowledge the integrity of the political process. It's a direct threat to our democracy. And regrettably, we're seeing it take form in the face of political violence that's potentially playing out. There's been the threat of it at polling places. It's not normal to say that we had people showing up at polling precincts while the early voting was going on, completely armed, and saying that they were there simply to watch voters go in. That's intimidation. It's wrong. And it really does pose, I think, a very real threat to our democracy.
Okay. Maya Barry, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us here on Al Jazeera. Let's cross over to our correspondent, Gabriel Elizondo. He's live for us in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. Now, this is one of the seats where Democrats were most hopeful of gaining in the Senate. Gabe, what are the results looking like?
Well, we have a little over 50% of the vote in, and John Fetterman, the Democrat, has a very narrow lead. It's still way too early to make any calls on this. It's just this is going to go on late into the night here, as everyone pretty much expected. However, I can tell you that the Fetterman campaign is looking at the numbers coming in, and they feel pretty positive. And that is because Fetterman, in some very pro-Democrat counties, Fetterman seems to be running better than Joe Biden did 2 years ago in the presidential election. And on the other side, in deep red counties, it appears that the Republican candidate, Mehmet Oz, is running a little bit below what Donald Trump's numbers were in red counties. So Democrats are looking at that and saying it's looking pretty good for John Fetterman, but it's still way too close to call. And with just barely over half the votes counted, we still have a very long night to go here in Pennsylvania.
And let's look at New Hampshire, the Senate race there. The Democrats were hoping to take a slight lead, at least. What's the result looking like there?
Yeah, New Hampshire was a race that the Democrats were starting to get a little bit worried about. The incumbent, Maggie Hassan, has a big money advantage over her Republican opponent there. She has more than $30 million that she spent on that race. Her Republican opponent, Trump-supported, someone who's never held public office before, only had $2 million that he was able to spend. And results are coming in, and it looks like Maggie Hassan is doing quite well. Has a fairly good lead at this point with more than half of the ballots in already. And so Democrats are a little bit breathing a sigh of relief at this point. Is it over? No, it's not. But the race appeared to be tightening in the last few weeks here. Republicans were dumping a lot of money into the race in the last few weeks, trying to bolster Buldick, the Republican candidate there. And we're hoping that maybe they could pull out a victory in New Hampshire. Still a little too close to call, but it looks like Hassan is on the way where she could potentially win in New Hampshire, holding that seat for the Democrats. That's a race that could be called fairly soon if the numbers continue to progress as they have been in the last hour or so.
Okay, well, as soon as it is called, we'll be bringing it to our viewers. Gabe, thanks very much. Let's go over now to Madison, Wisconsin, where we can speak to Heidi Jo Castro. I want to know what's going on there. We've got Ron Johnson, Mandela Barnes. It's a swing state. Joe Biden managed to flip it in 2020. Who's looking to be in a healthy lead there?
That's right. They are pretty much tied neck and neck at this moment with some 58% of the votes in that U.S. Senate race. Now counted, we're seeing that Mandela Barnes is in the lead by fewer than 6,000 points over the incumbent Republican Ron Johnson. And we'd expect that number to shift as the night goes on, given just how closely and evenly divided we know that historically voters in this swing state of Wisconsin are. You know, the last two presidential elections were indeed decided by fewer than one percentage point. And we saw the enthusiasm as voters were coming to the polls throughout the day. In early voting, there was a turnout of 35% higher in this midterm than the previous. There's another big race in Wisconsin, which is the governor's race at this moment. Still too early to call, but the Democratic incumbent, Tony Evers, has a slight lead over his Republican challenger. So those are certainly two things we're watching. But also of interest, of course, is the abortion issue, which we know has been a major factor in every race we're watching tonight. But in the neighboring state of Michigan, where I spent the last few days, that was one of the top of issues for voters, because voters in Michigan are being asked whether or not they want to support protecting abortion. And that's a direct ballot measure, the only race in this midterm elections that's directly asking voters about abortion. Well, so far with about 13% of those votes counted, it looks like those who do support abortion access are in the lead by a comfortable margin at this point, which is in keeping with what the polls has been showing. But very interesting to watch there, as certainly the question of how abortion would influence voters in this election was top of mind, given that abortions are no longer protected by the federal constitution, and now it's up to states, and the state of Michigan is answering how voters feel about it.
Okay. Heidi, thanks very much indeed. Let's go back up now to Washington, D.C. We can join Alan Fisher on Capitol Hill. Alan, just looking at the House results, the House of Representatives, we've got Republicans on 100, Democrats on 56. I mean, that would seem like quite a lead for Republicans, but they need to get to 210, don't they, to take the majority. So there's still a way to go. 218, I beg your pardon.
I've just been texting with a Republican operative, would probably be the best way to describe him. And I said, how's it looking? What do you think? And he said, look, I don't think the red wave is going to happen. I think the best we can hope for is a good night. But there is the possibility that this could be a disappointing night for us. So that was quite interesting. And we've been looking at some of the races that were going to be important if there was going to be a red wave. We talked about Abigail Spanberger down in Virginia. She has won. So that's now confirmed. Elaine Loria is another Democrat in Virginia. We said that that could be a key seat. She looks as if she might lose. That isn't official yet. Still a lot of postal votes to be counted there. But also Jennifer Wexler, also in Virginia, she has won her seat as well. So things not panning out quite as well for the Republicans as they'd hope, particularly in these key seats. Another interesting name is Lauren Boebert. Now, if you follow American politics at all, you might recognize her name. She comes from Colorado. She's a congresswoman. She has been very vocal in her protests against Democrats. She has flouted the rules in the House a number of times, and she's thought to be a darling of the right wing of the Republican Party. Her race is too close to call, and that is a real surprise. The Republicans would have been banking on her getting home. A couple of other results from earlier on. Maxwell Alejandro Frost, 25 years old. He won in Florida 10. He is going to be the youngest member of Congress and the first member of Gen Z to be elected as well. And another interesting result, not yet confirmed, but certainly heading that way. Chuck Grassley is going to win his Senate seat in Iowa. He is 89. Just to remind you, the Senate, when you win your Senate seat, it is for 6 years. He is the senior member of the Senate, which means that he is third in line to the presidency. If anything were to happen to the vice president and then the Speaker of the House, Chuck Grassley would step in. But he has won. It looks as if he's going to win his seat in Iowa at the age of 89 for another six-year term.
6 years at 89 years old, or rather him than me. Alan, thanks very much indeed. Let's go over to Washington, stay in Washington rather, and that's where Patty Culhane is going to bring in some more great chat with her guests.
Thanks so much, Laura. It is really getting to be a confusing night. So helping to break all of this down, my excellent panel, Nadia Brown is the professor of government at Georgetown University. That's here in Washington. Steve Clemens, familiar face, host of the Al Jazeera's The Bottom Line, fabulous show you should watch. He's also the executive editor of Semaphore because he doesn't have enough jobs. And James Davis, he's a Republican strategist. Okay, Grassley, we were just talking about Senator Grassley. That one I was watching, paying close attention to, because Iowa right now is in this place where abortion is being battled in the courts. And in Kansas, we saw abortion. It energized women to come to the polls. So abortion is on the ballot with Grassley because the Republicans have said they will try to make a national ban. What happened, Nadia? I know you said women can walk and chew gum at the same time, but this is a state where it's quite possible abortion rights will be taken away.
Yes, this is possible, and not entirely unexpected, right? But just because Grassley has won this race doesn't mean that I think it's a foregone conclusion that abortion rights or reproductive health is off the table. There are activists in the state who are working to really elevate women's voices. They're using other kind of legislative tools at the state level to try to kind of curtail a federal ban that might come down the pike. It's not to say that it's going to happen. It might be a Hail Mary pass. But I think what we don't want to lose sight of is grassroots activism and the way that women have mobilized for centuries oftentimes is not from the inside politics, but it's from outside.
James, you wanted to talk about the grassroots organization because, I mean, just 3 months ago, we were like, the Democrats are fired up. The Democrats are, and then it just went, whoop.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, you know, everyone gets distracted by these big campaign ads and the TV ads and stuff. And certainly those have an impact on the race. That's why people do it. But the hard work is the grassroots infrastructure and building that grassroots organization. It's the door knocks. AFP Action, affiliated with Americans for Prosperity, they've knocked on 11 million doors, 11 million doors. They've really pivoted more to a very precise group of voters. They're looking at all the races up and down the ballot, state legislatures, all the way through the federal races. They're looking at a target universe of 43 million voters, right? They've done 11 million door knocks. They've done phones. They've done more than 100 million pieces of direct mail. And then they've decided they're going to own the digital space, really targeting individual voters who, one, need to get out and vote, and two, people that could be persuadable in that swing audience with no spillover that that typical TV ads would get. And so they've served up more than 1.5 billion impressions to that 43 million people. And that's just in the digital space. Well, that is 38 impressions per person if you did the math in your head. It took me a while. I had to use a calculator.
I didn't do the math in my head. Not at all. But what were they getting fired up about? Why were people answering the door?
You know, people feel like they are paying more and getting less. We've talked about this, obviously, over and over, ad nauseum, but inflation, pocketbook issues are what people are concerned about overall. They're also interested and concerned about the rise in violent crime that we've seen in cities across the country. Look, if Democrats have a hard time turning out voters in the big cities, the Philadelphias of the world, and Atlanta, then that really changes the landscape of the election. That's what Joe Biden and historically Democrats really rely on is the coastal areas and the big cities. But unfortunately, because of inflation, because of the rise in violent crime, you see people voting with their feet. They're leaving these big states. They're moving to places like Florida and places like Texas. Why? The quality of life in these big cities is just not what they're looking for anymore. And I think you also see with the people who don't have that mobility, can't pick up and move, right, because of family, because of jobs, whatever, you see them exercising that vote in the ballot box. And so it's going to be, you know, margins, slim margins, but that matters a lot in close elections. And we're going to see some close elections, it looks like.
So, Steve, I'm so glad you're here because I don't know if our audience knows this, but Steve knows literally every single person who has any power, any pull, any sway in Washington. He texts them. They're buds.
Both sides of the aisle.
On both sides of the aisle. Yes, that's what makes you so good. So how are you reading this? What are you seeing?
Well, I guess what I'm seeing right now is when you look at, I was at a party earlier tonight, sort of pre-midterm election party, and it was a Republican tilting gathering, and there was a strident feeling that they Republicans were going to win 40 governorships out of 50, win 240 seats in the House, and win 54 Senate races. As we look at how things are playing out now, we should remind the audience that we don't know how all the, you know, the cards are going to be played yet, but that being said, those results are basically unachievable right now. So it's going to be less at some level than that. And we see dynamics that are really interesting and unusual that you wouldn't see if it was a major red wave. We have two likely female lesbian governors that are likely to win, one in Massachusetts, one potentially in Oregon. We have the first transgendered man who just won the first time in U.S. history in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is not a liberal state. It's a state with a lot of confusing currents, but you've got a first transgendered man who has won in a state house of representatives. So there are interesting trends that we weren't paying much attention to. But on the broader issue of abortion, it's something I find very different between the Republican and Democratic parties. Republicans have been focused like a laser beam on the Supreme Court and the justices in this country, almost single-mindedly focused on making sure that they achieved that, and they knew that the objective was to get a reversal on abortion, on Roe v. Wade. Democrats have been concerned about this for decades, but Democrats never took the court issue as seriously as Republicans, were distracted by many other grievances that they were doing, and behaving that while the abortion decision really did impact politics of this country, it was short-lived because the Democrats were distracted by other big issues, including Republicans. But it faded much as it did before, that there wasn't the same kind of focus. So I'm not surprised that it faced, but I do think that we're facing a very difficult time in the country as we look at how this plays out, of again, living in two nations, one nation where women have certain rights that are embedded in their state constitutions and protection, and other places where anything that tilts towards abortion becomes a criminal act. And I think that is something that this nation is not going to solve tonight and is going to be an ongoing ulcer for many years.
That's so fun. That's really fun. Thanks, Steve. I feel uplifted. So it's sort of a schizophrenic result, right? We're seeing these progressive candidates that you wouldn't expect to do well, but then at the same time, you've got Ron DeSantis who goes after
Prince. I mean, Ron DeSantis is the red wave. The red wave is in Florida.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump is trying to clobber Ron DeSantis right away because he now sees him as the most powerful force in the Republican Party.
So I guess we should just wrap it up and say weird times, but we'll see how it goes from here. But that's the latest from Washington for now. Back to you in Doha.
Well, Patty, that's what we like. We like weird times. It keeps it interesting. Thanks very much. While the Republicans have been making some gains in the House, the Democrats have performed above expectations, as we just heard from Patty there. Do stay with us here on Al Jazeera for our ongoing coverage.